Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. This podcast is also sponsored by DocketWise, an all-in-one immigration forms and case management solution trusted by thousands of immigration lawyers across the U.S. I really like DocketWise. It makes immigration applications easy by allowing the clients to provide information through simple online questionnaires that are shareable by text or email and available in multiple languages. Not only that, DocketWise provides a comprehensive group of case management features, including invoicing and calendaring, secure messaging, task management, and a lot more. You can learn all about DocketWise and receive a 10% discount on your subscription by heading to docketwise.com/immigration-review, so they know we sent you. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. Ladies and gentlemen, hobos and tramps, cross-eyed mosquitoes, and bow-legged ants. This is the podcast's 200th case law episode. I feel like Bilbo Baggins. Indeed, his words from his 111st birthday ring true for me as well. I don't know half of you half as well as I should like, and I like less than half of you half as well as you deserve. Or at least that's certainly true of my relationship with the circuits. What a ride, and I have no plans to stop anytime soon. I'd be lying if I didn't say that when I started all this, I didn't think about what this, the 200th episode, would look like, but I had little expectation of getting here. Well, here I am. Thank you all for listening, supporting, and emailing me over these nearly 4 years. Incredible. Also, and wonky as weird as heck, I know, but I'm a bit terrified because the First Circuit hasn't published a thing since February 2nd. Nothing. I'm talking everything including immigration. And that's a fairly active circuit, usually. I want to ignore it, but my gut tells me that there's a tech glitch somewhere in Boston that will soon flood me and like two other First Circuit court watchers with a bunch of published decisions. At which point we can commiserate as a trifecta. How about them apples? Four cases this week, starting with the perennial apple of my eye. First up is Matter of Azrag, published on Friday by the BIA. Interesting issue. Great attorney for the non-citizen. And a loss on what appears to be a bit of a trend with the BIA on issues like this of late. Mr. Azrag is from Sudan and became a lawful permanent resident of the United States. A few years later, however, he was convicted of two counts of theft under Section 21-5801 of the Kansas Statutes Annotated and sentenced to 12 months imprisonment for each offense. Probably only needed one conviction to make him removable under the facts of this case, which an immigration judge did find, and the IJ denied relief. An appeal was dismissed by the BIA in February of 2023. During that appeal, however, Mr. Azrag filed a motion with the Kansas State Court to get the conviction vacated. Thanks to Attorney General Barr's decision in Matter of Thomas and Thompson that Attorney General Garland has not vacated, post-conviction relief has become a minefield for immigration and criminal defense attorneys alike. The motion filed by Mr. Azrag's criminal attorneys with the Kansas court alleged that Mr. Azrag, quote, was not competently advised by counsel of the nature of the plea agreement, its terms, the resulting convictions, or its potential collateral consequences, end quote. Sounds to me that that's a Padilla-type ineffective assistance of counsel, substantive or procedural defect argument. Mr. Azhag, after all, had a Sixth Amendment right to competent counsel in his Kansas criminal proceedings, and the motion to vacate that conviction alleged that that counsel hadn't complied with the Supreme Court's mandate in Padilla that counsel properly advised criminal defendants of the immigration consequences of their pleas. In so many words, the prosecutor in Kansas agreed and let Mr. Azhag withdraw his guilty plea. However, quote, the motion was not accompanied by any evidence to support the allegation that the respondent's prior criminal defense counsel failed to competently advise the respondent, end quote. Nor would such evidence often be expected when the prosecution agrees, in cases such as this, in our adversarial system. The state court judge obliged the party's agreement, summarily vacated the conviction without much explanation, and amended the theft charge to something that is almost surely not a removable offense. As a state court would be expected to do with a docket in the hundreds, if not thousands, and with an agreement between the parties. No longer removable, Mr. Azhag filed a motion to reopen his removal proceedings and to terminate those proceedings with the BIA. The BIA denied that motion in this decision. So, Thomas and Thompson. Under that still unvacated Attorney General Barr decision, that itself vacated three BIA decisions. Quote, state court orders that vacate, modify, or otherwise alter a non-citizen's criminal conviction or sentence have legal effect for immigration purposes when based on a procedural or substantive defect in the underlying criminal proceeding, but not when the change was based on reasons unrelated to the merits, such as the non-citizen's rehabilitation or an interest in avoiding an immigration consequence, end quote. But unstated explicitly in this decision, ineffective assistance of counsel should qualify. That is a fundamental defect in the underlying proceedings, even when the ineffective assistance is based on a Padilla-type failure to advise of the immigration consequences. This case here before the BIA is, of course, a motion to reopen. This is not a case where the Department of Homeland Security has the burden to establish removability, even though it is a motion to reopen tethered to removability. Interesting issue. Anyway, though, as such, says the BIA, for the first time to my knowledge, post Thomas and Thompson, quote, a respondent seeking reopening after the entry of a final administrative order of removal based on the vacature of a conviction bears the burden to prove the conviction was vacated for a procedural or substantive reason, end quote. The non-citizen has the burden. Also important to the BIA, quote, in determining whether a conviction was vacated based on a procedural or substantive defect, we consider the law under which the court issued its order, the terms of the order itself, and the reasons presented by the respondent in requesting that the court vacate the conviction, end quote. At least when it's not clear from the judge's order alone. What Mr. Azhag submitted did not meet the BIA's burden here. Notwithstanding what was said in Mr. Azhag's papers before that state court judge, quote, the state court, hearing the respondent's post-conviction motion, did not find that the respondent's prior attorney had provided ineffective assistance of counsel and did not adopt or indeed even refer to the respondent's allegations, end quote. As to the substance of the motion filed by Mr. Azhag's attorney, the BIA gave it little weight, for, quote, just as statements of counsel are not evidence of what happened to a respondent in the past, they likewise cannot substitute for evidence of deficient performance by an attorney. Findings of fact regarding an attorney's conduct or conclusions of law regarding the violation of a defendant's constitutional rights, end quote. All of this meant here that Mr. Azhag did not succeed in getting his case reopened and may be physically removed to Sudan. I have thoughts. First, given the fact that even the BIA recognizes that its analysis is governed by the, quote, law under which the court issued its order, end quote, I would think that regardless of what the motions papers say factually, if the parties or the judge cite and rely on a state statute for vacating a conviction, and if that state statute lists only procedural or substantive reasons for vacating a conviction, that a non-citizen would meet their burden. The BIA itself specifically notes here that, quote, the state court did not specify the law under which it issued its order vacating the convictions, end quote. So it seems that a simple state statutory citation in the papers may go a long way, even where there's an agreement with a prosecutor, as a court does need some legal basis to vacate a conviction. Second, evidentiarily, if that's a word, couldn't all of this have simply been satisfied by a sworn affidavit from Mr. Azrag explaining that his, quote, prior criminal defense counsel failed to competently advise him, the respondent, end quote. Unsure if that was actually submitted here or not, but I'd think the BIA would have mentioned it if it was. There's great case law out of some of the circuits of late regarding the persuasiveness and indeed potential definitiveness of sworn affidavits in the motion to reopen context. Check out the podcast case summary page. But I must caution everyone, though. In its second-to-last sentence, the BIA seems to cast doubt on whether the moving papers or even the evidence can ever be sufficient, instead focusing heavily on the state court judge's actual order. Quote, where a state court order granting a respondent's motion to vacate a conviction does not indicate the reason for the vacature, and there is no other basis in the record to independently establish the reason, the respondent has not satisfied his burden to show that the court vacated his conviction because of a substantive or procedural defect in his criminal proceedings. End quote. That's a bit ambiguous with maybe some exceptions to me, but if it truly will be the case that the BIA or IJs relying on this decision in the future are to require factual certainty from the state court judges themselves, they will be applying a framework that largely ignores how state court judges operate in practice. Judges just as burdened as IJs, if not more so. It will add another hurdle for non-citizens seeking to vacate their criminal convictions, a hurdle upon a hurdle, really, that when you tell criminal defense attorneys that this is how it works, you are often met with disbelief. To conclude, remember too that nothing in this decision should apply where DHS bears the burden for removability purposes. And that is Matter of Azrag. Next is Singh Bhaktana v. Garland, published by the Second Circuit on February 22, 2024. This case is about asylum. And it's a relatively common claim of late, at least on a high level. A claim by a Sikh individual from India who supports the Man Party and who fears the governing BJP Party. But there's a twist. See, Mr. Singh Bhaktana testified that he was attacked by BJP members and operatives three times because of his affiliation with the Man Party. Important for this case, quote, after the first attack in December 2008, Mr. Singh Bhaktana relocated to a city, also in Punjab, where he lived for several years free from harm. In 2012, he decided to permanently move back to Kamprathala, but was attacked again shortly after his return, end quote. He was then denied a U.S. visa and relocated to Gurgaon, a place near New Delhi, for, quote, a few years, end quote, where he worked as a cab driver. Only when he returned to Kapurthala again was he attacked again in January 2015, after which he came to the United States. It appears that the IJ and BIA either found or presumed that Mr. Singh Bhaktana's experience rose to the level of past persecution. That gives DHS the burden to show that conditions have changed materially or alternatively, that Mr. Singh Bhaktana can relocate safely and reasonably. That latter analysis, whether relocation is reasonable, requires consideration of many things. What's more, and while surprisingly unstated in this decision, but by regulation where the persecutor is a country's government, relocation is presumptively unreasonable. Makes sense, as they control the whole country, right? Here, of course, BJP is the governing party of India. The IJ and the BIA, however, concluded that Mr. Singh Bhaktana's own experience in India showed that he could reasonably and safely relocate. And the Second Circuit affirmed that. The court explained that Mr. Singh Bhaktana lived in two cities outside of his home state of Punjab for 5 or 6 years, without harm, despite his continuing to support the Man Party. The Second Circuit, therefore, quote, discerns no reason why he could not be able to relocate to those places again and be free from harm, particularly as there is no legal restriction on internal movement within India, end quote. Nor did the agency or Second Circuit believe, contrary to Mr. Singh Bhaktana's argument, that he was living in hiding during his time in these other cities. Rather, he was apparently going to Man Party meetings, attending Sikh temple, and driving a taxi. In addition to this, the Second Circuit doesn't read the Department of State country condition report as really helping a Man Party-based claim, at least as of 2016, and prior Second Circuit precedent from 2006 also seems to undermine the factual argument that Man Party members and Sikhs in general face significant threats countrywide in India. And all of it meant here that Mr. Singh Bhaktana lost his case. And that is Singh Bhaktana v. Garland. Are you tired of answering your own phones? Or of wasting your valuable time on unqualified consultations? Staffy Live is the only 24/7 live receptionist and intake service specialized on immigration law. Staffy Live specialists are highly empathetic, bilingual individuals who know how to deal with adversity, have a background in client care, and are trained to qualify callers by asking the right questions. Staffy Live goes one step ahead in only scheduling qualified consultations on your calendar and then doing follow-ups when needed. Staffy Live is giving a 15-day free trial for any law firm interested with no strings attached. To apply, visit www.getstaffy.com. That's GETSTAFI.com. And click on Get Started. Make sure to put in the code FREE. Links, of course, in the show notes. This podcast is sponsored by Driftwood Capital. Driftwood Capital boasts a 30-plus year track record, transacting on more than $3 billion in hospitality assets. Since 2015, Driftwood Capital has successfully implemented the EB-5 program into their development deals, helping more than 160 families find a secure path to residency through their projects. Driftwood Capital is a vertically integrated commercial real estate firm specializing in hospitality with dedicated acquisitions, development, lending, and management divisions. Their goal is to create long-term partnerships with its network of more than 1,200 active investors from the United States and abroad while targeting attractive returns. Driftwood's unique approach involves managing all aspects in-house, from developing renowned hotel brands such as Marriott, Hilton, and Hyatt, to managing their portfolio of more than 80 hotels in the United States. If you want to learn more about Driftwood Capital, check out the show notes. And of course, let them know who sent you. Next is, Singh v. Garland, published by the Eighth Circuit on February 23rd, 2024. Two Man Party asylum cases in the same week with the last name Singh. Before you roll your eyes, though, remember, there would have been a fair amount of meritorious asylum claims from Germany in 1938 with the same last name, had the option been available. Just saying. Here, though, as in the Second Circuit decision, Mr. Singh did not succeed, and in keeping with many Eighth Circuit decisions, it's a short one. Really, Mr. Singh didn't have much of a chance here. After five hearings and continuances, and possibly having still not found an attorney, Mr. Singh appeared for his merits hearing and said, quote, he needed more documents from India that he did not identify, and that he could not go forward today, that he was not prepared, that he was mentally unable to go forward with his case, and that he was under pressure, end quote, and that he would not be testifying that day at his merits hearing. To the IJ and the BIA, Mr. Singh's refusal to testify and provide information about his claim meant that he couldn't meet his asylum burden, and so the agency denied his application as abandoned. Looks like all of that went to the Fifth Circuit, where perhaps Mr. Singh was detained at the time, I don't know, and the Fifth Circuit dismissed the petition for review. Still in the US in 2021, Mr. Singh filed an untimely motion to reconsider with the BIA that was denied. Later that year, he filed a motion to reopen, alleging materially changed country conditions in India. Quote, he alleged that the ruling party in India has outlawed demands for a separate Sikh Khalistan, that in March 2021, its members attacked Mr. Singh's father for hiding Mr. Singh, a Khalistani terrorist. And in April 2021, Mr. Singh became an active member of the organization Sikhs for Justice, end quote. And as Khalistani terrorists is in quotes in this decision, I imagine that's only an allegation from the Indian government, allegedly. Mr. Singh further argued that the immigration judge violated his due process rights in denying a continuance for the April 2020 hearing because of the COVID-19 pandemic's impact on his mental health and on his ability to obtain supporting evidence from India. The BIA denied this motion, too. The problem, said the BIA, was that Mr. Singh, quote, offered no comparison of current country conditions to those in 2020, end quote, meaning that to the BIA, he had not shown that conditions had materially worsened. The BIA rejected the other due process stuff, too, as did the Eighth Circuit. Not sure why we're at the Eighth Circuit and not the Fifth Circuit, but whatevs. In the Eighth Circuit, quote, the BIA does not abuse its discretion when it determines that new evidence, even if previously unavailable, is not likely to change the outcome of the proceedings, for example, because it is cumulative, end quote. The Eighth Circuit saw this as what Mr. Singh was presenting, at best. It also agreed with the BIA's rejection of his due process arguments. I'd tell you more, but the analysis is one paragraph without any specifics, so what can I do? Mr. Singh's case will not be reopened. And that is Singh v. Garland. Which brings us to United States v. Ivey, published by the Sixth Circuit on February 20th, 2024. Concluding with the crime of violence case. Mr. Ivey is presumably a U.S. citizen, and he pled guilty to possession of methamphetamine with the intent to distribute and being a felon in possession of a firearm. Not recommended. His sentence got enhanced based on the district court's finding that a prior conviction he had for aggravated robbery with a deadly weapon under Ohio Revised Code Section 2911.01A1 was a crime of violence. But that was not correct, said the Sixth Circuit. There are actually two crime of violence definitions for this sentence enhancement guideline purposes, and the Sixth Circuit analyzed both of them, but only the elements clause crime of violence definition is materially identical or really in any way similar to the immigration aggravated felony crime of violence definition, so that's what I'm going to talk about. The Ohio statute makes it a first-degree felony for an offender to possess a deadly weapon and, quote, either display the weapon, brandish it, indicate that the offender possesses it, or use it, end quote, while attempting or committing a theft offense as defined in Section 2913.01 of the Revised Code, end quote. Section 2913.01 in turn identifies more than 30 different theft offenses. Some of those theft offenses are quite serious and dangerous and seemingly violent, like, say, robbery, quote. But the list of theft offenses also includes seemingly less serious offenses, such as tampering with coin machines, safe cracking, insurance fraud, and workers' compensation fraud, end quote. Maybe that's serious, but it's obviously not violent. And actually, it's pretty simple to the Sixth Circuit. Zooming out, there are pretty much three federal contexts where pretty much the same crime of violence definition is at play. The Armed Career Criminal Act, the Immigration Aggravated Felony Crime of Violence, and this one, the Sentence Enhancement Guidelines. Last year, in the ACCA case United States v. White, a case that appears that I missed or perhaps simply mentioned in another summary, the Sixth Circuit actually held that Ohio aggravated robbery, this statute, isn't a crime of violence because it doesn't have a sufficient mens rea following the Supreme Court's Bourdain decision. As the Sixth Circuit explained in White, following Bourdain, a crime of violence in the Sixth Circuit at least requires, quote, as an element, the knowing or purposeful use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against the person of another, end quote. Immigration crime of violence also allows for that force to be against property. Now, it does look like some of those 30 underlying theft-type offenses have that as an element, but some don't. No discussion here as to whether Ohio Revised Code Section 2911.01A1 is divisible as to the type of underlying theft committed, but I have a feeling that that's what was probably held in White, because the Sixth Circuit says here that the conviction can't be a crime of violence, quote, without further information that the aggravated robbery conviction is predicated on a particular underlying theft offense, end quote. And how could you tell that under the categorical approach unless this Ohio statute is divisible as to the 30 ways to commit theft? Later in the decision, the Sixth Circuit does indeed actually explain that under its prior precedent, this Ohio aggravated robbery statute is, quote, twice divisible. That is, the statute not only requires a court to determine the type of aggravated robbery at issue, but also which of the more than 30 theft offenses mentioned underlies the conviction, end quote. So there you go. It's divisible. Twice divisible. But here, the state court indictment and judgment for this aggravated robbery conviction does not identify the predicate theft offense. Which means that the government, which had the burden of proof in its effort to enhance Mr. Ivey's federal criminal sentence, couldn't meet its burden. And it meant that Mr. Ivey got years off his sentence of imprisonment. Begs the question to me, though, as it so often does. If the state court indictment and judgment in this case for aggravated robbery does not identify the predicate theft offense, how can it be that the predicate theft offense is actually an element rather than a means of committing this offense, such that a court can even look to the documents in the first place? Because by definition, then, the Ohio prosecutors didn't have to prove, and a jury didn't have to find, what the underlying theft offense was. I probably need to go back and read that White decision, though. Maybe it was explained. But in any event, it means, as it so often does in these cases, congratulations to the Federal Public Defender's Office, this time out of Cleveland, and specifically, Catherine Adenaro Shesky for Mr. Ivey. And I guess it means no need to tangle with matter of Azrag if your client has this Ohio conviction. Good discussion on the federal definitions of generic robbery and generic extortion, too, in this one, if that's ever needed in your case. And that is United States v. Ivey. So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all, and follow the show on Instagram and Facebook at Immigration Review, or send us a tweet at imreview, that's I-M-M, review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review.